bird note. Redwood forests attract millions of visitors every year. Unfortunately, the food left behind by people brings trouble for wildlife. Marbled murrelets are secretive little birds that spend most of their lives at sea, but they breed in the redwoods. Thick, moss-covered branches are like ready-made nests for the murrelet's single egg. After hatching, the chick's speckled down keeps her camouflaged in the canopy, while both parents fetch fish to feed her. Much of the marbled murrelet's historic range has been destroyed by logging and wildfires. And while North America's remaining redwood forests are protected public lands, predators are moving in. Steller's jays and common ravens are just two opportunists that thrive on our food scraps. And once they've eaten our leftover trail mix, their next meal may be a murrelet egg or chick. The Keep It Crumb Clean campaign is a state park initiative that's educating people about the importance of leaving no food unattended. That means storing food in secure containers, disposing of waste in animal-proof bins, and cleaning up all food, even crumbs. BirdNote has inspired millions of people to take action for birds. Learn more and join us at birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
We are fueled by your support. You make CJSF.
Welcome to Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me as per usual is Brandon. And this week we are joined by Sylvia Berryman, UBC professor of philosophy, who initially focused on the classics, Aristotle, Plato, the Greeks, but has now transitioned over into looking at toxic virtue during the imperial period. And so that's what we're going to be talking about with Sylvia today. Sylvia, we're really happy to have you on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to say to introduce yourself?
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here. Yeah, it's a really new project for me. As you mentioned, the 19th century is quite a long way from the ancient Greek world. And part of the attraction for me was that we know so much about it. I was working on a project about how virtues change in going back to Socrates and the idea that he had in fact helped the Athenians or encouraged the Athenians to change their idea about what justice was. But we know so little about the popular reaction to Socrates, and even what we know about Socrates is filtered by through such odd sources, people like Plato. So it was a real thrill to be looking at virtue change in a period that's so well documented, where you can actually just go online and look at the newspapers that some of these authors were reading and get a sense of their background and their intellectual environment.
You've sent us over a little bit of the materials from your project that you're currently working on, and there's a lot to go on. As you say, there was a lot of writing, a lot of discussion, a lot of political discourse happening within this period that really covers the topics that you're focusing on. Just even the impact of having things like newspapers and journal articles and advertisements and all this kind of stuff that was so prevalent in the imperial period really gives us, of the British Empire to be more specific, really gives us a unique look at the ideas that people had at the time and the way that they analyzed themselves and their own activities.
Interesting to hear that you've got a history background, because I think that's one thing that other people have noticed about a lot of philosophy, that we tend to write in the abstract as though we're not located in time and space, and to think about problems really abstracted from the context. Whereas as a historian of philosophy, I tend to think, no, we have to look at what's going on around in the intellectual world. And this project of actually looking at virtue change as it happens in history, for me, was such an exciting one. I was very inspired by a book by Kwame Anthony Appiah called The Honor Code, where he actually looks at some virtue transformations in different historical periods, where he's looking for what he calls moral revolutions. And that was part of my inspiration to say, well, yeah, we can look for instances of ethical change and really learn from those by looking closely at history.
Set the stage a little bit for us, like, I guess, talking about the history. At the opening of the period that you're looking at, which kind of seems to be the late 18th and then obviously the 19th century of British Empire, what was sort of like the birth of the philosophical ideas going on at the beginning of this period that kind of gave rise to what we're majorly going to be focusing on?
One thing I'm not doing here is looking at necessarily the philosophical history of the 19th century in the sense of the formal academic philosophy. I'm looking at figures who are speaking to the broader public, particularly the middle classes, which is a growing period in the Victorian world. And I'm looking at the virtue discourses as they work out in popular culture, particularly those reaching the middle classes. So I do have one or two philosophical academic authors because they had a popular impact, because they did have a popular reception. But I'm also looking at anything from a cookbook to an operetta to poetry to there's a painter, and looking for authors who had a significant impact on the virtue discourses of their time, maybe giving things a new spin or taking the contemporary virtue discourse down a particular path. Never completely new, but perhaps a little bit innovative. These authors who we know had a broad impact, that had some influence on the way that the Victorians saw themselves. And I'm asking, which of these virtue narratives were actually influential in the conduct of the British Empire? And because I think, you know, if we look at looking for a case where virtue discourses went badly wrong, I think we can agree from this vantage point that imperialism was a project that has some really deep ethical problems. And yet, interestingly, a lot of British middle class participants, not necessarily the decision makers, but the people who are signing on as administrators or soldiers or civil servants or perhaps missionaries during this period, saw themselves doing something that was good, that they were making sacrifices for, that they were serving other people. You know, from our perspective, there's something really interesting here, right? How could people be so badly wrong? And this is why I chose this particular period, because I think it's fairly widely agreed that there's a turnaround in Victorian values, say around the time of the World War I, Great War, as they called it, where there's a bit of a collapse of the consensus that everybody's on the same page with virtues, with there's a difference of agreement about whether these values that their parents perhaps or the previous generation were so confident in, whether these are actually doing good. When a society turns on its own virtue discourses, to me that's a really interesting case where we can examine what's going on and try to take a closer look at some of the kind of structural problems in the Victorian ideas about virtue and why these led to such horrible impacts in the conduct of the empire.
Looking over some of the material that you sent us, this real focus on, you know, you might call it like popular virtue or the popular ideals of the time, how people thought about themselves, how they justified what they were doing, how they felt important or satisfied or proud about their position and, you know, their actions is really, really fascinating, as you put it. And in many ways is, I don't want to oppose the two, but in many ways I could see how it's more historically impactful to look at, okay, how were regular people in the empire you know, within the, you know, citizens of the empire, not, you know, not colonial subjects, thinking about themselves in terms of ideals, in terms of virtues. That is something that millions of people lived with and thought out and expressed day to day for, you know, well over a century in the case of what you're looking at. And so it was very interesting to see, you know, all of this kind of fit together. And as you said, all the things that you can draw on from that, whether it's, you know, it's not just exegesis from, you know, very, you know, kind of ivory tower philosophers, you know, at Oxford or whatever. It is more importantly about thinkers and regular people. And as you said, the burgeoning middle class, you know, how they thought about themselves, what was important to them within the context of empire. And I think that's it's very interesting. It's a very interesting perspective. And I think it's really important. I'm really quite you know, impressed and interested overall.
Thanks. I'm really interested to see how people react to this, because it's not a common way that we do philosophy, right? We don't normally think about going into historical cases in order to try to learn about how ethics works, how ethical change comes about. But I was inspired by, particularly by Appiah's work. I've also been reading Hannah Arendt, who does some extensive look at historical cases, another philosopher I find really interesting. I'm interested what your response is as philosophers. Brenda, do you have a history background too?
So I don't necessarily have a history background, but I should say that one of my interests is in Hannah Arendt as well. The principal text that I kind of engage with is her kind of final posthumous work, The Life of the Mind. I understand that a lot of the sort of content of that is historical as well, except she's developing historicity of mental faculties and particular mental activities. In the human condition, she's also establishing a sort of historicity of politics in that regard. So I think it's really clear how Hannah Arendt would be an inspiration for this particular sort of let's call it a mode of doing philosophy, this particular way of historicizing virtue and taking it into a historical dimension. That was one of the other interesting things that jumped out at me, was because this is what is sort of novel about the project, is that when philosophers, academic philosophers, you're absolutely right, when they engage with virtue discourses, it's in this very abstract kind of, you know, deconcretized way almost, right? Like, the thing that immediately jumped to my mind when I began reading the introduction was a really great, one of the chapters from Alistair MacIntyre's A Short History of Ethics, where he criticizes Aristotle on the megalopsuche, right? The great-souled person, how the megalopsuche actually consists of an excess, which kind of contradicts Aristotle's, you know, virtue is the mean, right? But this is completely, like, it's entirely confined within Aristotle's system itself. He's calling Aristotle out on a contradiction. He does historicize it a little bit by saying that, well, what seems problematic about this is just that we don't think that we think that people should be equal. We don't think that there is greatness in consisting in an excess. And I think that even Aristotle would not agree with that. I mean, that's what, if you read the Apology, Socrates is a bit of a megalopsuche. He's kind of, in the Apology, he's pumping himself up saying, I deserve free meals at the Hall of the Olympians, and he gets executed for it, right? So they wouldn't even agree with Aristotle's assessment. So there is kind of like the opportunity for MacIntyre to have made that historical analysis. But again, it would have been completely confined to that period. And his assessment is completely conceptual, right? It's within Aristotle's system. What's new here in your project is that the historical element is necessarily two-pointed, right? You're examining a particular period from within its own lens, and that gives it its plausibility as, like, here's why they held up these virtues. But now, outside of that period, where we can kind of cast a backwards glance, we see that these virtues were, as you're calling them, toxic. They have some kind of negative impact, or we just actually think they're not virtue ideals, right? And that's what that distance from the past, I think, is a condition for doing something like historical philosophy. But that hasn't really, I mean, again, your inspirations in Hannah Arendt and Appiah do kind of anticipate this work, but it's not a common way of doing this at all. It's one that lacks the kind of concretizing. The source materials that you're drawing from are these very urbane kind of texts. Like, you're looking at cookbooks and the ideals that would have been sort of espoused within these. And there's, so I find that the project, it expands what philosophy is permitted to examine, in that it's allowed to sort of examine the particular virtue discourses and the way that the distance between the now and then is going to kind of illuminate how we see those.
That's really illuminating. I like the way that you draw that contrast, because actually one of my inspirations was the figure of Socrates, right? So you know, famously we think about the way he changed the Athenians' view about what counts as justice. So they thought that justice included, you know, an eye for an eye, retaliation. And as an imperial power, they were doing horrible things to their retaliate to their enemies, right? And realizing it, that, you know, they vote to go and basically slaughter a city that rebels against them. And the next day realize, whoa, no, that was not the right decision. And Socrates got this real challenge to the Athenians, where you're thinking about justice the wrong way. So he's not challenging the idea that justice is good, right? These ideal, vague, general terms like courage or justice are staying the same, but it's how you articulate them. What's the spin that you put on it? Is justice returning what you owe? Is it giving as much as you get, returning on equal, or is it something that's never harmful? And that's an argument that Socrates is making. He personally is changing the understanding of justice. And I actually started out by writing a book on Aristotle and Socrates, and with the idea that Socrates is actually Aristotle's model for the phronimos. He's making these situated decisions about and convincing people, yeah, this is the right way to see this situation. It's not to retaliate against the generals. It's not to obey this illegal order. It's to have the courage to disobey an order. And that's a different notion of courage, where everyone else thinks it's about obeying on the battlefield, standing firm, not about telling truth to power necessarily, right? So that's, again, changing the general kind of, they call them the speech day virtues, and giving it a slightly different spin. So I'm looking at the way that these articulations of more general virtues work out in the period. Looking at quite concrete, everyday exemplars, influences, if you like, people who had a big readership, and where it's plausible. I don't need to say that you can exactly trace ideas to this one person. Of course you can't. There's always going to be some references to ideas that are already in the culture in order for somebody to be able to have that kind of impact. But the thought is that, yeah, that the practices and the experiences that were going on during 19th century imperialism were to some extent fueled by these virtue discourses. Of course there's other stuff, right? There's power hungry, there's greed, there's racism, and there's all kinds of bad ideas around, and I'm not denying that those play a role, but it's surprising how many people seem to be recruited for idealistic reasons to participate in this project. And there's something about I'd really like to understand better what it is about these virtues that went so wrong.
I think you hit on something there, and even talking about the transition that Socrates made in the idea of justice, this kind of tension that you also sort of brought up that I thought was a very interesting kind of entry point was, you know, obviously within the activity of empire, you have all this kind of nastier, more on the ground material stuff, right? The exercising of power, of violence, of, you know, of wealth, the accumulation of wealth and property or whatever it might be, all this kind of stuff happening. But there's also this tension on the other hand going on with the idealistic idea of the empire that becomes the sort of mental space that people occupy to think about what the British Empire actually is. And I really think that the kind of tension between the two is a really interesting starting point to think about, okay, well, what is really going on here and what are the justifications? Because clearly the British Empire was a militaristic, expansionist, colonial power, right? There's, and as you said, there's all this baggage that goes along with that. And yet you have very, very different, at least to our eyes, very different ideas of what that all means or the purposes or justifications for all that to the average everyday, you know, imperial member, right? I think it's a very interesting entry point, and it's a really important thing to think about because it's like the tension is so clear, right? And it's the same sort of tension that, you know, also, ancient Athens was dealing with as well in terms of their own imperial activities and people like Socrates.
And that's a great thing about having this historical insight, right? That we've got enough distance that ideas that were taken for granted at the time look a bit different to us, right? And we can ask, okay, what was going on? And yet we're close enough in time that we have access to the texts that we can get this wealth of information about what people were thinking.
How do these sort of well-intentioned ideas, how do they relate to the actual toxic virtues that are going on, right? Like, what are some examples of that activity actually happening?
Well, so let's talk through an example. I actually grew up in England myself. I was born there and came to Canada at age 13. So I'm sort of an insider and an outsider. And some of these texts were ones I grew up with, three of them, I think. But others are completely new to me. I'm not a Victorianist. I had to learn a lot of this. I thought I knew something about the 19th century. Totally wrong. Part of the interest is at this project has been learning so much. I started with Arendt's book, The Origins of Totalitarian Britain. I was teaching it during COVID, teaching online with a group of students who were in their homes, in their home countries. And because Vancouver BBC is a very international university, it was just a fascinating experience because there were students from all around the world. And we were very conscious because you could see some people getting up at the crack of dawn in the other side of the world to join in our class. And with it coming, say, from South Asian students with a very different perspective on 19th century British imperialism, which is what Arendt's talking about. She's talking about the ways that the British imperial administration was creating some of the tools for 20th century totalitarianism. And she mentioned Kipling at one point and just stopped and talked with the students about what their experiences with Kipling, because he was the most popular writer in English for a couple of decades, and yet he's so little known today. And surprisingly, some students had still grown up on The Jungle Book or some of his other work, but others were really conscious.
I did.
You did too.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah. A lot of my family is British as well, so I have a follow up to this. But yeah, please continue.
Okay. Yeah. But he also has this very real imperial presence. A century and a half later, reading some of his work with such a diverse group, not quite a century and a half. Very interesting perspective. What was your question?
Oh no, I was just going to say that I have a lot of, I grew up with Kipling as well, and these sorts of stories, like I have a direct connection as well in terms of the British Empire. My great-grandfather was a cartographer for the British Empire, And so he spent much of his time in Africa. And even through my family, like my time growing up and my family stories, the reference points and the framing was always very heroic. You know, he was an adventurer in the jungle. He was, you know, out on these crazy missions. He did all this wild stuff, this big life, you know, and a very classic British guy who would, you know, smoke a pipe and play croquet and read Kipling and all this kind of stuff, right? And so there's that kind of, even to today, you see the, the lag of this sort of mythology and kind of hero worship of the kind of adventurer and the British imperialistic traveler. There's a little bit of a different perspective now.
Right, very much, yeah. I mean, one of there are so many people I could have included, and one of the people who I thought about including was David Livingstone, because he's actually one of the archetypal Victorian heroes, because he combined this personality of the missionary and the explorer. So different virtues there. And the thought that drove the virtue narrative here is that this idea that he had was that by bringing commerce, by bringing different forms of trade to the African continent, that this would actually be a way of combating slavery, because it was an ongoing slave trade, and Britain was very committed to the idea that it had been the ones that had ended the Atlantic slave trade, and their part of their justification as imperialists, their reason for believing in their own moral superiority, was that they'd gone from being the premier slaving nation in the Atlantic to really trying to shut down that slave trade. And now they were becoming aware through the work of these missionary travelers of the extent of the slaving networks within Central Africa. And Livingstone had this thought that you could crowd out the slave trade by bringing in other kinds of commerce. This idea that there's some belief in the well-intentioned good that might come from what we now see as oppressive and colonialist policies came from some of these virtue narratives.
And I know, looking at some of the thinkers and authors that you kind of investigate, one of the ones that popped out to me, who I think most of our listeners will be familiar with, was John Stuart Mill. He's the utilitarian guy. That's how we kind of know him. But there's also this sort of civilizing mission that he kind of espoused, or sort of, you know, had this ideology around, that very clearly links up with something going on, as you sort of hinted at too, with kind of, you know, the ending of the slave trade as sort of the mission of the British Empire, that I think a lot of people don't really realize as well about him and his sort of, you know, influence on the period.
Mill is so fascinating. And I do include On Liberty as one of the texts, because I do think it had this public presence, and still, I think even in the mid-20th century, was almost kind of an official philosophy of a lot of English-speaking liberal academia. Another of the texts, like Utilitarianism, that still gets read in Canadian philosophy departments today. So yeah, but I actually am reading it as a virtue text, not simply as an argument for political policies, because I think hidden behind it, and other scholars have done this work to help make this case, there are some positive values about this eccentricity, the genius, the person who spurs a kind of cultural progression. Also that there's certain kinds of minimal criteria that Mill thinks are necessary in order to qualify to be a self-governing society. He explicitly, as an employee of the East India Company, which he was for decades in his life, he explicitly denies that India is ready for self-governance, which is staggering when you think about his role as, you know, the bastion of liberty and the promoter of autonomy and self-governance. So that's a real conundrum. And there's some really great scholarship now particularly by people who were interested in the history of imperial thought and imperial ideology.